Good evening. The debate free-for-all. Democratic socialism versus the billionaire candidate. And the C-word, communism, rears its head in Las Vegas. Roger Stone faces 40 months, and indigenous people fight for their rights throughout Canada. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Thursday, February 20th, 2020. President Donald Trump named a vocal loyalist and ambassador to Germany to lead the country's intelligence community on Wednesday. Richard Grenell will become acting director of national intelligence, overseeing 17 constituent agencies. Since Dan Coats stepped down from the position in August after months of conflict with the White House, the government has lacked a Senate-confirmed official in the job. The office played a key role in allegations of Russian interference when DNI officials blocked the whistleblower complaint from being forwarded to the House and Senate intelligence committees, setting in motion events that led to Trump's impeachment and acquittal by the Senate. Grenell is an openly gay former Fox News commentator. He's come under fire for tweets targeting women. And last night, the Democratic candidates for president gathered to debate in Las Vegas, Nevada. It was the first debate where the newest candidate, the former mayor of New York and multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg, got a chance to join the fray. Bloomberg has skipped early primaries and is betting an unprecedented fortune of hundreds of millions of dollars that he can sweep the Super Tuesday primary on March 3rd, when primary voters in 14 states with a third of the delegates make their decision. The debate was arguably the most contentious of the Democratic candidates, and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and Bloomberg clashed early on over Sanders' Democratic Socialist policies, policies the former New York mayor likened to communism.
What we need to do to deal with this grotesque level of income and wealth inequality is make sure that those people who are working, you know what, Mr. Bloomberg, wasn't you who made all that money. Maybe your workers played some role in that as well. And it is important that those workers are able to share the benefits. Also, when we have so many people who go to work every day and they feel not good about their jobs, they feel like cogs in a machine. I want workers to be able to sit on corporate boards as well, so they can have some say over what happens to their lives.
Mayor Bloomberg, you own a large company. Would you support what Senator Sanders is proposing?
Absolutely not. I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. It's ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
So let me make a proposal that will work, that has not only support from a majority of Democrats, but also from a majority of independents and a majority of Republicans. And that is a 2-cent wealth tax on all fortunes above $50 million. You hit a billion, you got to pay a few pennies more. This is a tax on the top 0.1% in America. And it permits us to start to restructure our economy. It means we can afford universal child care for every baby in this country age 0 to 5. It means we can have universal pre-K for every child in America. It means we can raise the wages of every child care worker and preschool teacher and stop exploiting the black and brown women who do this work. It means we can put $800 billion into our public schools, quadruple funding for Title I schools. And as a former special education teacher, we could fully fund IDEA so children with disabilities would get the full education they need. We could do college. We could put $50 billion into our historically black colleges and universities. And we could cancel student loan debt for 43 million
Senator,
Americans.
Thank you.
That's something a majority of Americans support, a 2-cent wealth tax. It is a question of values. Do we want to invest in Mr. Bloomberg, or do we want to invest in an entire generation of young
Senator Sanders, the next question is for you. Senator Sanders, our latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll released yesterday, 2/3 of all voters said they were uncomfortable with a socialist candidate for president. What do you say to those voters, sir?
What was the result of that poll? Who was winning?
The question's to you.
Well, the question was that I was winning, and I think by a fairly comfortable margin. Mike mentioned that. But here is the point. Let's talk about democratic socialism, not communism, Mr. Bloomberg. That's a cheap shot.
and Senator Elizabeth Warren participating in that part of the debate. The other candidates, including South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg, Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, and former Vice President Joe Biden, all took turns jumping on Bloomberg and his billions.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
I actually welcomed Mayor Bloomberg to the stage. I thought that he shouldn't be hiding behind his TV ads. I don't think you look at Donald Trump and say, we need someone richer in the White House.
Let's put forward somebody who actually lives and works in a middle-class neighborhood in an industrial Midwestern city. Let's put forward somebody who's actually a Democrat. Look.
The one thing that I'm really worried about, embarrassed about, was how it turned out with Stop and Frisk. It got out of control.
And it's not whether he apologized or not. It's the policy. The policy was abhorrent. And it was, in fact, a violation of every right people have.
I have no tolerance for the kind of behavior that the Me Too movement has exposed. In my foundation, the person that runs it's a woman. 70% of the people there are women. In my company, lots and lots of women have big responsibilities. They get paid exactly the same as men.
And I hope you heard what his defense was. I've been nice to some women. Mr. Mayor, are you willing to release all of those women from those non-disclosure agreements so we can hear their side of the story?
There's agreements between two parties that wanted to keep it quiet. And that's up to them.
We are not going to beat Donald Trump with a man who has who knows how many non-disclosure agreements and the drip, drip, drip of stories of women saying they have been harassed and discriminated against. That's not what we do as Democrats. Mr. Vice President.
I believe in democratic socialism working people, not billionaires.
What a wonderful country we have. The best known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What did I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, House 1.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, House 2.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a summer camp. Forgive me for that. Where is your home? Which tax haven
do you have
your home?
New York City, thank you very much.
Yeah, right.
And I pay all my taxes. And I'm happy to do it because I get something for it.
And Mitch McConnell, I've been the object of his affection and the president's affection. The way he's gone after me, this new Republican Party, after me, after my son, after my family. I don't need to be told I'm a friend of Mitch McConnell's. Mitch McConnell has been the biggest pain in my neck in a long, long time.
And that's what we are saying, Pete. It's maybe it's a time for the working class of this country to have a little bit of power in Washington rather than your billionaire campaign contributors.
Hey, all right, look, first of all,
John, I know. And if there are a few people who make ugly remarks, who attack trade union leaders, I disown those people. They are not part of our movement.
But leadership is about what you draw out of people. It's what it's about how you inspire people to act.
I have an idea of how
can
we
move
can
us forward.
Stop sexism on the internet. We could nominate a woman for candidate for president of the United States.
Mayor Buttigieg really has a slogan that was thought up by his consultants to paper over a thin version of a plan that would leave millions of people unable to afford their health care. It's not a plan, it's a PowerPoint. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note, insert plan here. Bernie.
I'm more of a Microsoft Word guy.
I must say I take personal offense since post-it notes were invented in my state.
And one of the issues raised in the debate was Bloomberg's longstanding support of fracking. That's a technology using explosives and toxic fluids to free up natural gas deposits that were formerly unavailable for exploitation. Fracking is widespread in swing state Pennsylvania, while banned in neighboring New York. Senators Sanders and Warren have been opposed. The policy director of Food and Water Action is Mitch Jones. He says Bloomberg's assertion that opposition to fracking will alienate swing state voters are false.
This is a false narrative that's been being pushed recently by the oil and gas industry and by the mainstream media, including places like the New York Times and the Washington Post. But the most recent actual polling data out of Pennsylvania on fracking shows that a strong plurality, in fact, almost a majority of Pennsylvanians support a ban on fracking. We've also seen in recent years candidates running on anti-fracking platforms in Pennsylvania winning elections. So the actual evidence for the claim is lacking. And if anything, the real evidence shows that there is more support for a fracking ban in Pennsylvania than there is opposition to it. Candidates are running on that message and they're winning in Pennsylvania.
There was also a mention that fracking also applies to oil, which I forget which candidate said that, but I got the idea that opposing fracking might hurt America's self-reliance on oil.
Fracking is also used for oil. It's used for both oil and gas. But the fact of the matter is that we have to end our reliance on oil and on gas, as well as coal, which has nothing to do with fracking, if we're going to have a habitable planet in the years to come. We know that over the next 10 years, we have to drastically reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And by the middle of the century, we have to eliminate them. We're not going to be able to do that if we continue to pump oil, drill for gas, burn it, turn it into other products like plastics.
Doesn't look like Bloomberg was in favor of your ideas. Which candidates do you think were most in line with what you're saying?
Bloomberg's been a supporter of fracking for a very long time. And in fact, opposed when he was mayor of New York, opposed the fracking ban in New York. What we're seeing is that a handful of candidates have come out for a ban on fracking everywhere. Of the candidates still in the race, that's really just Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And having looked at the climate platforms put out by the candidates, I really think that it's the Green New Deal proposal that the Sanders campaign put out that is the boldest plan that actually meets the scope of the climate crisis that we face. It's centered on banning fracking for a fair and just transition for the workers in the fossil fuel industry who we need to take care of, make sure that they're kept whole in terms of wages and benefits while we bring new manufacturing jobs to those communities that are predicated on a sustainable, green, renewable energy industry here in the U.S.
Mitch Jones is Policy Director of Food and Water Action. You're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A shoving match broke out between supporters and opponents of convicted Trump advisor and friend Roger Stone at his sentencing in Washington, D.C. on Thursday. Stone was sentenced to 40 months, significantly less than the 7 to 9 years that was originally requested by prosecutors. Stone was charged with lying to the government during the investigation of special counsel Robert Mueller into allegations of Russian meddling in the 2016 election. Trump had criticized the sentence recommendation, inserting himself in a federal criminal case in a way seldom seen in American politics. Trump reiterated his support for Stone and repeated his verbal assault on the jury forewoman in Las Vegas from Las Vegas shortly after the sentence was handed down.
Now, you see a lot of press back there. So before we go any further, I want to address today's sentencing of a man, Roger Stone. Roger Stone. He's become a big part of the news over the last little while. And I'm following this very closely, and I want to see it play out to its fullest because Roger has a very good chance of exoneration, in my opinion. I've known, and you people understand it probably better than anybody in the room. I've known Roger Stone and his wife, who's really a terrific woman.
And Attorney General William Barr, in a rare break with Trump, demanded the president stop tweeting about federal criminal cases, claiming it impeded his work. But some are saying Barr's complaints are a smokescreen. Former Judge Bill Blum has an article in the Progressive magazine titled Unequal Justice: The Feud Between Trump and Barr is a Grand Illusion. Blum says Barr is giving Trump cover, and the result is a further diminishing of democracy.
What is at the heart of it is that the line prosecutors in the Department of Justice are furious at Barr's and Trump's intervention in their work. you know, line prosecutors really want to be non-political in the sense that they choose cases and act upon them, not because they are Republican or Democratic issues, but because that's what they believe the law requires. And so there is something of a rebellion going on among the rank and file in the Department of Justice. Barr, as the head of the Department of Justice, has to quell that rebellion. But I think Barr has his sights set on the larger goal that he has had for decades, which is encapsulated in what I wrote about, this theory of the unitary executive. Barr is a proponent of one of its stronger versions, promotes and advocates executive branch supremacy.
Of the governments we learn about and the societies that have come and gone when we're taking high school and junior high school history, what compares to what Barr and Trump are building here?
One that comes to mind, and this may sound even now a little over the top, is a comparison to what went on in the early days of the Third Reich. Legally speaking, the Third Reich pursued a policy of consolidation, which meant that all of the pre-existing legal institutions, the well-developed court structure that Germany had, would be preserved, but ultimately would be subservient to the objectives of the party and the Führer. And when Trump promotes himself as the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, who can meddle and interfere in ongoing criminal cases, it is somewhat reminiscent of that idea of coordination. We have to coordinate the work of the Department of Justice with Trump's desires and his policy agenda. That's really a frightening thing, and it does represent a sharp departure from the post-Watergate wall of separation.
And as former Judge Bill Blum, who has an article in the Progressive magazine titled Unequal Justice, the feud between Trump and Barr is a grand illusion. And a federal appeals court on Wednesday upheld a ruling giving Florida ex-felons the right to vote regardless of fines and fees associated with their convictions. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed a district court's previous decision, saying a Republican-led effort to require ex-felons to pay up before they can vote, a requirement that in some cases could cost individuals thousands of dollars, violates the Equal Protection Clause. But the decision was hailed by voting rights groups, including the Southern Poverty Law Center, which represented two plaintiffs in the case. Nancy Abadou is the organization's deputy legal director for voting rights.
Last November, we had over almost 65% of Floridians who voted for the automatic eligibility of certain individuals with criminal convictions to get their voting rights restored. And then in May, that was 2018. In May, the Florida legislature passed a law that said you could only be eligible for automatic restoration of rights if you satisfied all of these financial obligations, fines and fees and court costs and restitution. So the Southern Poverty Law Center, along with several organizations, have sued the state, arguing that this financial requirement is equivalent to a poll tax and really a form of wealth-based discrimination, essentially meaning that poor people will be permanently locked out of the ballot box.
And so how did the court rule on that?
We had two very favorable rulings, one in the lower court where the court did grant what we call a preliminary injunction. So while we finished the entire case, that law is technically, or part of it is on hold, because of this impact on people who are low income or otherwise lack the financial ability to pay their obligations. And then the state, because they're so adamant about making sure that poor people don't vote, appealed that decision to the 11th Circuit. And just this week, we got a great decision from the 11th Circuit saying that, yes, there is no rational reason why you should require someone who cannot afford to pay these fines to pay them solely as a condition to vote.
And Nancy Abadou is the Deputy Legal Director for Voting Rights for the Southern Poverty Law Center. And finally, a dilapidated snow plow, three tents, and some barrels sit beside the snowy tracks of the Canadian National Railway in Tainan Dingawa, Ontario, a protest in support of Indigenous leaders trying to stop the construction of a gas pipeline thousands of miles away in British Columbia. The blockade set up by the Mohawks of that town may not look imposing, but the barricade and similar ones erected at transport points across the country have disrupted travel for Canadians since last week and drawn attention to the pipeline dispute. Yesterday, Canada's Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said it was past time to get the problems between Canadian nationals and Indigenous people right.
It is time, past time, for this situation to be resolved. But what we are facing was not created overnight. It was not created because we have embarked upon a path of reconciliation recently in our history. It is because for too long in our history, for too many years, we failed to do so. So finding a solution will not be simple. It will take determination, hard work, and cooperation.
And John Cain is a Mohawk and host of Let's Talk on WBAI. He says all Indigenous rights are at stake.
There is an effort to put a gas pipeline through Wet'suwet'en territory in British Columbia. And there's been an effort by the people there to resisting this thing for over 10 years. What happened recently, and it's not the first time, but the recent issue sparked up because the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, went in 2 weeks ago and arrested a bunch of people and, frankly, roughed up some people, including some women. And that sparked outrage across Native territories throughout Canada and the United States, for that matter. I mean, this isn't unlike what the whole Standing Rock issue was all about, other than the fact that this pipeline is actually going through very, very pristine Native territory. That is, frankly, the Wet'suwet'en actually had a Supreme Court ruling a few years back that made it very clear that they own title to that land, that it's their land. It's not Canadian, it's not Canadian land, it's Wet'suwet'en land. So after this this assault that took place with the RCMP, Mohawk people in particular, first in a place called Tandanega, which is between Toronto and Montreal, and then several other Mohawk territories, many of the people there decided that they were going to step up and they were going to either block railways, highways, or in some cases even a few border crossings. Even the Senecas got involved out here near Niagara Falls, Buffalo, the Peace Bridge. Many of the people, and this wasn't necessarily something that came from a tribal council resolution. It was the activists within each community said, no, we're going to stand in solidarity with the people of Wet'suwet'en. And the reason the blockades were twofold. One, to pressure the RCMP to leave the Wet'suwet'en territory, and two, to stop the pipeline. And this became such a big issue. And basically, these blockades have been in place for like 2 weeks, and it was really starting to have an impact on the Canadian economy. So just 2 days ago, there was a special session of a parliament in the House of Commons in Ottawa that began with the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, with some commentary from the opposition leader, the Conservative Party leader, Andrew Scheer, a couple of other folks, one minister from what they call the NDP, the New Democratic Party, and another provincial minister from British Columbia, and one from Quebec. It's pretty dramatic testimony. I mean, the overt racism that came from the Conservatives, not unlike what we see on the U.S. side, and at least some compassion, if not only lip service, that came from some of the other folks, it was pretty dramatic. But the idea that Native people stepped up and raised enough of an issue that it commanded a House of Commons hearing is pretty significant. And although there still isn't a resolution, I will say that there's been some offer over the last couple of days where the RCMP said, well, we'll leave as long as you're going to let the pipeline workers in. And, of course, it kind of defeats the whole purpose of why they're there in the first place. And some of the response that has come from especially the traditional folks, the hereditary chiefs in Wet'suwet'en territory said, look, you can't. We're not going to negotiate with you putting a gun to our head. That's what's been transpiring. It is still a very fluid and dynamic situation. No blockades have been lifted. Actually, a few more blockades have happened over the last couple of days. But it does look like there's an increasing amount of pressure being put on the Canadian government to do something about the RCMP's presence there. And the problem is you'll have some people who want to say, well, this, it's not a Canadian federal issue. You know, the Canadian politicians don't dictate what the RCMP should do. There's a lot of doublespeak that's happening. But that's the situation. And in fact, next week, after I do my show, Let's Talk, I'm going to be hosting a screening of a film called Invasion, which kind of shows that 10-year struggle that the people have been going through.
There's been a lot of activism with the Highway of Tears. I just read a book about the Highway of Tears and how so many indigenous women have disappeared in that area, been found dead, and others never found again, and that the feeling that some of these oil workers are exactly that kind of misogynist personality that comes in and starts...
Well, part of it is the condition that where these workers, how they live. Because what happens with these pipelines and these extractive industries is they create man camps where these men leave their families, their wives, their children, and they go and they live there for months at a time in these remote areas. And frankly, that's where many of these women turn up missing. And, you know, there's a lot of indication of the Sex Slave Trade Act, prostitution and all kinds of other things that are incorporated. So that's why there's a connection between the Highway of Tears and these extractive industries.
And John Kane, a Mohawk, is host of Let's Talk on WBAI. And that's some of the news for Thursday, February 20th, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.